Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. What do you remember from your first paid job? Did you develop any work habits that you carried into adulthood? Are there jobs you had when you were younger that you strongly disliked and could only appreciate after many years passed? From your 20s on, has much of your identity been shaped by the work you do? Perhaps too much? Poems on this next month's episode offer a variety of perspectives on work, starting with a child's job. Let's begin with a poem by Jericho Brown, who visited Astoria in 2021. On stage at Liberty Theater, he read many of his poems, including one titled Labor. It recounts the speaker's boyhood Saturdays cutting grass. His poem describes his interactions with the elderly women who hired him and then opens out to reflect on his childhood. This is Jericho Brown's poem, Labor. I spent what light Saturday sent, sweating, and learned to cuss, cutting grass for women kind enough to say they couldn't tell the damned difference between their mowed lawns and their vacuumed carpets just before handing over a $5 bill rolled tighter than a joint and asking me to change a few light bulbs. I called those women old because they wouldn't move out of a chair without my help or walk without a hand at the base of their backs. I called them old, and they must have been. They're all dead now, dead and in the earth I once tended. The loneliest people have the earth to love, and not one friend their own age. Only mothers to baby them, and big sisters to boss them around. Women they want to please and pray for the chance to say please too. I don't do that kind of work anymore. My job is to look at the childhood I hated and say, I once had something to do with my hands. That's Jericho Brown's Labor. Curiously, though the poem is titled Labor, Brown avoids any account of the sweaty labor of cutting grass. The poem does let us know the old women who hired the speaker gave his work their stamp of approval. They were kind enough to say they couldn't tell the damned difference between their mowed lawns and their vacuumed carpets. Certainly, the speaker was intent on pleasing the old women who hired him. From his adult perspective, the speaker realizes that, of course, by now, those women who hired him are all dead, all laid to rest, the poem says, in the earth I once tended. The poem's next sentence, spilling out over five lines, starts out sounding like he's still reflecting on these old women, but it takes a subtle turn. He says, the loneliest people have the earth to love, and not one friend their own age, only mothers to baby them, and big sisters to boss them around. Women they want to please, and pray for the chance to say please too. Is the speaker referring to his own lonely childhood, friendless, babied by his mother, bossed around by his older sisters? Perhaps. The poem's final three lines focus on the speaker and his attitude toward his past. I don't do that kind of work anymore. My job is to look at the childhood I hated and say, I once had something to do with my hands. It may be that without getting sentimental about it, he appreciates the work he did, the mutual kindness shared with elderly neighbors. As a poet and teacher, sedentary, sweating over a page, the speaker now expresses satisfaction with the manual labor of his youth. He's arrived at a belated appreciation of the solitary work he did decades ago. Let's hear the full poem once again. I spent what light Saturday sent, sweating, and learned to cuss cutting grass for women kind enough to say they couldn't tell the damned difference between their mowed lawns and their vacuumed carpets just before handing over a $5 bill rolled tighter than a joint and asking me to change a few light bulbs. I called those women old because they wouldn't move out of a chair without my help or walk without a hand at the base of their backs. I called them old, and they must have been. They're all dead now, dead and in the earth I once tended. The loneliest people have the earth to love, and not one friend their own age. Only mothers to baby them, and big sisters to boss them around. Women they want to please, and pray for the chance to say please too. I don't do that kind of work anymore. My job is to look at the childhood I hated and say, I once had something to do with my hands. Again, Jericho Brown's poem, Labor. I admit I'm perplexed why these elderly women would pay the speaker with a $5 bill rolled tighter than a joint. As is the case when I read a poem, some passing reference, even a few lines, might refuse to yield its meaning to me. That's all right. I trust that the poems I read on air are smarter than I am. If we presume there's an autobiographical dimension to Jericho Brown's Labor, then it must be set in the late 1980s or early 1990s. Though there is a timeless quality to the concerns he expresses, even if professional landscaping crews seem more common now than young people sweating away a Saturday cutting the grass. Our next poem by Seamus Heaney takes us to rural Ireland in the 1940s or 1950s. The crowded home just across the border in Northern Ireland that Seamus Heaney shared with his 8 siblings, parents, and an aunt, was thatched roofed. There was no indoor plumbing. An outdoor pump provided drinking water, and a bucket of this water sat on a stool in the scullery. Rainwater would be collected off the corrugated iron roof of the cow barn and used for washing up. But the thatch, of course, could not collect rainwater for later use. Water simply could not run off of it. The thatch also absorbed smoke from the chimney. Seamus Heaney's poem, Thatcher, details the labor of a meticulous expert in a nearly lost trade. And we may presume the young Heaney observed closely the periodic visits of the thatcher to his family home. One term Heaney uses is not in my everyday vocabulary. Couchant, C-O-U-C-H-A-N-T, which means lying flat with one's head raised, the position assumed by the thatcher, who, of course, can't be walking over his workspace. This is Seamus Heaney's poem, Thatcher. Bespoke for weeks, he turned up some morning unexpectedly, his bicycle slung with a light ladder and a bag of knives. He eyed the old rigging, poked at the eaves, opened and handled sheaves of lashed wheat straw. Next, the bundled rods, hazel and willow, were flicked for weight, twisted in case they'd snap. It seemed he spent the morning warming up, then fixed the ladder, laid out well-honed blades, and snipped its straw and sharpened ends of rods that, bent in two, made a white-pronged staple for pinning down his world, handful by handful. Couchant for days on sods above the rafters, he shaved and flushed the butts, stitched all together into a sloped honeycomb, a stubble patch, and left them gaping at his Midas touch. Seamus Heaney's poem, Thatcher. Can we picture this Thatcher from 70 years ago, riding his bike and carrying a light ladder, a bag of knives, sheaves of lashed wheat straw, and bundled rods of hazel and willow? The Thatcher would show up unexpectedly and stay for days to finish his work. Even though he's hired by people accustomed to working with their hands on the farm, the Thatcher's expertise astonishes them. As the final line asserts, he left them gaping at his Midas touch. This Thatcher's not turning the straw into gold, as the mythical Midas would do, but metaphorically, he restores the roof, transforms it with his labor. Heaney does not share any personal insights on this bike-riding Thatcher, nor on his own family members who marveled at his work. The poem locks in on the expertise of this worker who pedals so humbly to his worksite. The tone is more than respectful. It's full of awe. The Thatcher's a well-respected craftsman. Let's hear the poem once more. Bespoke for weeks, he turned up some morning unexpectedly, his bicycle slung with a light ladder and a bag of knives. He eyed the old rigging, poked at the eaves, opened and handled sheaves of lashed wheat straw. Next, the bundled rods, hazel and willow, were flicked for weight, twisted in case they'd snap. It seemed he spent the morning warming up, then fixed the ladder, laid out well-honed blades, and snipped at straw and sharpened ends of rods that, bent in two, made a white-pronged staple for pinning down his world, handful by handful. Couchant for days on sods above the rafters, he shaved and flushed the butts, stitched all together into a sloped honeycomb, a stubble patch, and left them gaping at his Midas touch. Seamus Heaney's poem, Thatcher. On a previous episode of Poems for Company, I read another poem by Seamus Heaney, and I remarked on his muscular verbs. He displays that same trait in Thatcher as well. Slung, eyed, poked, opened and handled, flicked, twisted, fixed, snipped, sharpened, shaved, flushed, stitched. It makes perfect sense to describe this artisan emotion with a generous supply of active verbs. I like to imagine 10-year-old Seamus sitting on the ground, mesmerized as he watches the thatcher at work. In the 19th century, roughly half of the Irish population lived in thatched cottages. Today, just over 1,000 exist in Ireland. I presume that when Heaney published this poem in 1966, he could already foresee that thatched dwellings were becoming endangered species. High insurance rates make them prohibitive. And of course, with fewer roofs of straw to repair, fewer thatchers are needed. When was the last time you saw a milkman? My grandfather, in his youth, worked in a bowling alley as a pin setter. That sounds a bit dangerous to me. I've never seen a person manually set the pins. So many jobs that required skill and finesse have vanished. Let's go back further in time and consider a curious poem that records the actions of workers on urban streets. To be more specific, this next poem takes us back over 200 years to a London neighborhood where many people conduct their business. This poem refers to jobs that define this earlier era, and now some of these jobs may be obsolete. Today, when we walk urban streets, half the folks who circulate on the sidewalks stare at their phone or talk into their Bluetooth. We're likely to hear one-sided phone calls of our fellow pedestrians, all those conducting a business deal, explaining what they want for lunch, or coordinating a secret rendezvous. In contrast, the British poet Mary Robinson, who wrote over 200 years ago, takes us for a walk in London on an early summer morning around 1800. Robinson emphasizes the sounds of the workers. Her poem allows us to hear the way business was carried out back then. Also, six of her poem's sentences begin with the word now. Robinson emphasizes she is capturing her present. There's a vivid immediacy to the sounds and sights of the London she wakes up to. This is Mary Robinson's poem from 1800, London's Summer Morning. Who has not waked to list the busy sounds of summer's morning in the sultry smoke of noisy London? On the pavement hot, the sooty chimney boy, with dingy face and tattered covering, shrilly bawls his trade, rousing the sleepy housemaid. At the door, the milk pail rattles, and the tinkling bell proclaims the dustman's office, while the street is lost in clouds impervious. Now begins the din of hackney coaches, wagons, carts, while tinmen's shops and noisy trunk makers, knife grinders, coopers, squeaking cork cutters, fruit barrows, and the hunger-giving cries of vegetable vendors fill the air. Now every shop displays its varied trade, and the fresh sprinkled pavement cools the feet of early walkers. At the private door, the ruddy housemaid twirls the busy mop, annoying the smart prentice or neat girl, tripping with band box lightly. Now the sun darts bursting splendor on the glittering pane, save where the canvas awning throws a shade on the gay merchandise. Now, spruce and trim in shops, where beauty smiles with industry, sits the smart damsel, while the passenger peeps through the window, watching every charm. Now, pastry dainties catch the eye minute of humming insects, while the limy snare waits to enthrall them. Now the lamplighter mounts the tall ladder, nimbly venturous to trim the half-filled lamps, while at his feet the potboy yells discordant. All along the sultry pavement, the old clothesman cries in tone monotonous, while sidelong views the area for his traffic. Now the bag is slyly opened, and the half-worn suit, sometimes the pilfered treasure of the base domestic spoiler, for one half its worth, sinks in the green abyss. The porter now bears his huge load along the burning way, and the poor poet wakes from busy dreams to paint the summer morning. That's Mary Robinson's poem from 1800, London's Summer Morning. I count 15 different workers in this poem, identified by job distinction. That includes the sooty chimney boy with dingy face and tattered covering, who shrilly bawls his trade. That is, a small boy who can fit inside a chimney with his broom, breathing in ash, starts his day outdoors drumming up work by calling out for potential clients. A reminder that no child protection laws were enforced in 1800. A dustman, that is, a trash collector, rings a bell to announce his presence. Mary Robinson highlights the acoustics of the street. Knife grinders, coopers, squeaking cork cutters, and the fruit and vegetable vendors make noise that fills the air. The potboy yells discordant, the poem says, and the old clothesman cries in tones monotonous. These London streets are messy as well as noisy. The ruddy housemaid adds to the filth as she twirls her busy mop, which annoys the smart prentice and the neat girl carrying a band box with hats or gloves, perhaps, in it. Where's this smart prentice off to, and will he work with his hands or sit at a desk? Also, Mary Robinson is alert to class distinctions, who's doing the work and who's being waited upon. This neat girl and the smart damsel may be the only two non-working-class individuals named in this poem. The cork cutter would use an extremely sharp knife to shape corks to stop bottles. A lamplighter, nimbly venturous, as the poem says, climbs the ladder he carries to trim the half-filled lamp. A pot boy, that is, a servant from a nearby pub. An old clothesman, crying out in a monotonous tone about his garments for sale, which perhaps he pilfered. And a porter bears his huge load. That tally of workers on the street on this summer morning takes us to the final two self-referential lines. and the poor poet wakes from busy dreams to paint the summer morning. Mary Robinson slyly inserts herself into her poem. She reminds us that writing is work too, just not noisy work like that of all the others. Most of the poem's sentences begin midline, but that tendency to keep the flow going, to catalog the various sights and sounds, does not disguise Robinson's reliance on blank verse. That is, unrhymed iambic pentameter, which means, essentially, every line follows a 10-syllable pattern of unstressed, then stressed syllables. Consider again the poem's opening 3 lines, which consist of a question and then a phrase that begins to detail the scene. First line, who has not waked to list the busy sounds? Second line, of summer's morning in the sultry smoke. Third line, of noisy London, on the pavement hot. And the poem continues. Curiously, after 40 lines, Robinson closes the poem by upending the blank verse pattern. And the poor poet wakes from busy dreams, that's 10 syllables, to paint the summer morning, that's just 7 syllables. By upending the meter, the rhythm the previous 40 lines maintained, Robinson abruptly allows the poem to snap shut. Most any time a poet disrupts a pattern, we should wonder why. Robinson did not write a 7-syllable line in error. Her abrupt closure emphasizes her role as recorder of the sounds and sights of her London setting. Robinson opened her poem with the question, who has not waked to list the busy sounds of summer's morning in the sultry smoke of noisy London? Well, one obvious answer, nobody who's alive today. But Robinson does create a vivid portrait of a time lost to us from over 220 years ago. When we hear it, the scene nearly comes back to life, with all those jobs conducted by folks across a wide age range. There are many poems about work, and I will continue with the same theme on next month's episode of Poems for Company. You may listen to any episode of this show whenever you like. Go to KMUN.org, click on the podcast tab, and then click on Poems for Company. There you will find a credit list of all poems read on the show. If you have any suggestions, questions, corrections, contact me, Brian Dillon, at feedback@kmun.org. Our theme music is Philip Auberg's Going to the Sun from his CD, Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thank you for listening.